Ago, I woke up with this sermon running through my head on a loop, and it wouldn't kind of leave me alone. It was like having It's a Small World in your head for a while. And when I woke up the next morning, I couldn't quite remember it entirely. I mean, maybe you've had that happen as well, where and something you figure it's stuck in your head. There's no way you can forget it now. But the next morning, when I woke up, I was trying to grasp it, and I didn't quite have it. Well, it was nice because it revisited me in another couple of nights, and it woke me up again. And so then I thought, well, maybe I should preach this. And so I remembered it the next morning after that, and that turned out to be a good thing. People who have been in my class for several years will feel like this is repetitive, but I still think it is worth speaking about, and I also kind of try to sum it up into the space of a half-hour sermon here. I want to talk to you this morning about worldviews. So that's not a distinctly religious term, right? The concept of a worldview, although sometimes people will link it back to a religious idea, right? But it isn't a religious concept. The idea of how you see the world and yourself in it and your relationship to everything that is in it, other people, the self, a God, if you believe in a God, but even atheists have worldviews. Their worldview has, they believe, no God. We'll talk about that in just a minute. But your worldview is the total summation, right, of how you see yourself and how you see all of existence. It wraps up your metaphysics, your ethics, your epistemology, everything that you believe about truth, morals, and why you are here and what you're supposed to do about it. So the Bible, because God, of course, is incredibly wise, communicates a worldview, but it doesn't do it the way that we might expect it to, right? It might seem that you might read a book on a worldview, and then this says, here's what you should believe. You should believe in a God, and you should believe in this, and you should believe in that. But as Hollywood knows, worldviews are better communicated through story, through narrative, through description, through some sort of dramatic event. That's not to say that God is trying to pull a fast one, because he's not, but that really gets it into our human minds, doesn't it? When you watch a lot of movies, you get a worldview out of it. Now, if you're conscious of it, sometimes movies get a little too, you might use the term preachy with a worldview, right? I mean, have you ever watched one of those where it's really strong in your face about a particular topic, maybe some political thing that it wants to tell you about and seeks for you to believe. And so the good guy in the movie is, let's say, I don't know, a liberal vegan. And then the bad guy is an oil executive. And so it's clearly trying to communicate things to you through the actions of the story. And if you're conscious of it and you happen to disagree with it, then it becomes obvious and you can reject it. The more dangerous ones are the ones that are really good stories and really well done, but the worldview is not obvious, and that can kind of sneak in and bend your whole mind one way or the other. The Bible communicates a worldview in almost every single page, and it begins in Genesis 1:1. So whenever I try to write a sermon or anything, what's the hardest part to write? Have you ever talked about this maybe a little bit sometimes, but the beginning, right? The first line. First lines of books are legendary. Call me Ishmael, right? And automatically you know I'm talking about Moby Dick, okay? First lines of books, first lines of anything are what kicks the whole thing off. And usually they'll actually tell you, write the middle part if you know what it is, and then fill in the first part later, because otherwise you'll sit and stare at the empty paper for, you know, hours and hours at a time while you try to get exactly the right opening. And we're just that way. We know that it's true. God begins his book how? So I think that first line is telling, isn't it? In the beginning, God. We've already learned something here, right? In the beginning, God. We've learned what is there in the beginning, God. It only talks about one God, right? And on top of that, what isn't there yet? Just at that point, in those first four words, in the beginning God. In the beginning God, we can picture like a dark room, if you will. Nothing's there. There's no world, there's no universe, there's no stars, there's nothing. There's only God. He's there before anything else is. And so we already have something being drawn out for us. We already begin to see that God is not his creation. And so if we understand that aspect and we take it into us and we really digest it, okay, we really understand it, we begin to perceive that things like pantheism, the fancy word that means that people believe that God is creation and creation is God, very common, popular belief among New Age people, right? The idea, Shirley MacLaine back in the 70s when the New Age movement was in full swing, she would tell her audiences, be still and know that you are God, right? Horribly blasphemous, but the basic New Age concept of God is the world and the world is God, that you are all a small part of God, that God is one with his creation. That's a pantheistic argument. That's what pantheism means. And yet Genesis 1 denies that concept in just the first four words, in the beginning God, because he's alone and he hasn't done anything to creation yet. And then the next word is what? In the beginning God created, right? So now he is beginning to do something. He's going to move, and he created what? The heavens and the earth. And so now nothing is, you're not here yet. People aren't here yet. Animals aren't here yet. Plants aren't here yet, right? He's still got a bunch of things he's going to do in the rest of Genesis 1. But in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And have you ever thought about the fact that he doesn't talk there about stars or anything yet? He hasn't created that yet, but yet he doesn't talk about the vastness of the universe. And yet we already have this little hint that's begun to materialize of a God that is, it's like the focus point is changing, right? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, right? The earth is this tiny little blue marble. Okay, you've seen those things where it backs off from, it has this molecule, and then it backs out, and then eventually you see a person, and then it backs away from the person to their house in the city, and then out to the country, and then out to the little blue globe. The earth looks so big in that picture, but then it comes out like this, and then you've got the solar system, and then the solar system comes out like that, and you're sitting in a galaxy, right? And the earth is like unseeable at that point. And then it draws out again, and you have countless galaxies spread across the screen. And so the Earth seems small and insignificant, and in many people's worldview, it is. It is small and insignificant. It's an accident, right? Then we begin to come into we begin to smell the atheist worldview, okay? But God says, no, in the beginning, God created the heavens, and then he scopes it down, and the Earth. And in the rest of Genesis 1, we'll talk about what he does on the earth, right? As he begins to scope that down to what? Who's the culmination of Genesis? In the beginning, God's created the heavens and the earth, and then he ends up with the creation of man. Understanding that there is a difference, that there's a fundamental difference between God as creator and his creation is so critical to understanding the entire Bible, who God is, who you are, how we relate to the whole world, why humans are different than everyone else, why we worship God, why we don't worship anything else at all that is created. Worship only moves from creation to creator. That's made clear in Romans 1. Romans 1, 20 through 21, for his invisible attributes, speaking of God, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world. Okay, so there he is. He's linking the power of God back to his creation. In the things that have been made, so they are without excuse, for although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Jumping forward just a few verses, God, it says, therefore God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves. But why? because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator who is blessed forever. Amen. So Romans 1 speaks of this creator and creature distinction. The idea that the two are different and that worship only flows from creature properly to creator. Now mankind, there's within humans this desire to worship creation. Either the way that they did it thousands of years ago, okay, when they would just, you know, as Isaiah 44 makes fun of, carve up a piece of wood, cut it in half, throw one half of it in the fire, start to cook your dinner. Spend some time whittling down the other piece, set it in the corner. After you get your dinner done, you go over to the piece set in the corner and you thank it for creating you and giving you this good meal, right? The little chunk of wood that you just carved up. Okay, God mocks that, the idea that the creation is worthy of worship. But we humans do this over and over again, and within us, the idea of, we would call that idolatry, right? The concept of an idol, and that type of idolatry is obvious. The idea that you can put a little idol there and then you bow down to a block of wood, or you bow down to a little gold statue, or you bow down to, like the silversmiths would make the little statues that you could buy, apparently, after you went to visit Artemis Temple in Ephesus, and then you could get yourself a souvenir. And then later on, you could bow down to your souvenir, right, in Acts. And so Paul comes along and says, these people aren't gods. These things aren't gods. And it causes a huge city ruckus at that time. And so that's just obvious to us. We look at that and say, that's idolatry. And that seems pretty obviously wrong. And, well, none of us do that. We don't have a big problem with people bowing down to wood or stone or rock in America these days. But the odd thing is that almost all atheist ideas end up boiling down to some sort of variant of idolatry. It's always a worship of creation instead of creator. As the song said, when we behold the wonders of creation, right? So the song that we sang before the lesson helps us to understand that God is an infinite being, an omnipotent and an omniscient being. I'm going to call him an absolute, right? So what do we know already from Genesis 1:1 is that the God who created the world and all that exists is an absolute being. He is not like you or me. I sometimes tell my class that he's not just a superhero. He's not just an incredibly powerful superhero. As you know, in superhero movies, there's always a more powerful superhero. No matter what you get, there's somebody else that's going to come along and be stronger, better, faster, because you need some sort of, you know, tension here. When you're speaking of a God who's capable of speaking a universe into existence, you're not talking about a superhero. There's not going to be another God out there that is stronger than him. He doesn't have a kryptonite. He doesn't have a weakness. He's not like you, but just stronger. He's another thing entirely. He's an absolute, but he also is something else. And if we move on just a little bit into Genesis, going to verses 26 through 27, no, I'm sorry, go just to verse 3. Just hop together a couple of verses. It says, "And God said, let there be light, and there was light." Now what do we have? If we just had Genesis 1:1 by itself, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, we might almost say that something like the Big Bang could be seen as a God, right? In the beginning, the Big Bang created the universe and all that exists. We might say some sort of form of some other non-intelligent thing just barfed out the universe. But once God speaks, we now see another part of God that is an important thing for us to understand, and that's specifically that he is a person. Now, I already said earlier that he's not like you and me. He's not a person in that he's human, but he's a personality. He has a will and an intention. He's capable of speaking. It says later on that after each one of the days, what does it say? And God saw that it was good. Okay, so he's pronouncing things as good or not good. He's making judgments about the things that he has created, and he is speaking. He is a person with a personality. Now, this becomes so critical to our Christian worldview, the idea, and it's so fundamentally different from the secular worldview, because we begin with a personality, an absolute, infinite personality, a person with a will who is pre-existent and outside the universe, starts everything, and then creates all of what is impersonal, okay? All the things. This is impersonal stuff, right? All this, the stars, the planets, the ground, all these other things are impersonal things. The atheist worldview goes the other direction, right? It begins with the impersonal. It starts with matter, motion, time, chance. And then the impersonal somehow, over millions, over billions of years, at some point, a particular chimpanzee with a particular variant of chromosomes that tweak just a little bit finally develops a will and a personality. And then you have a person. So the atheist worldview begins from the impersonal, from matter, from motion, from time, from chance, things that are just like a machine, right? And accidentally, at some point, generates the personal. The Christian worldview is exactly opposite from that. It begins with the personal, with a God who we are told is love at one point, right, in the scriptures, a God who is kind, a God who is just, a God who is merciful. And so we see that all the things of a personality, okay, a person, actually pre-exist the immaterial, the things that are impersonal. So the things that are elevated up by our very secular worldview, the things that we take in a when our secular mindset is to take the things of that are impersonal and elevate them. And then to try to figure out, for example, how on earth morals evolved. Well, how did that happen? If they're accidental and they come from the impersonal, then they cannot have evolved. They just are meaningless. Now, this becomes something that's very difficult for people to live with. They look at what is meaningless and they say, well, wait a second. No. There must be some reason why we are good and we make judgment calls about what is good and what is bad. Where does such a thing come from? The Christian has no problem with that because we derive things like justice and mercy and love, okay, from the first four words of Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God. In the beginning, God, the God who is love, the God who is kind, the God who is just, the God who is merciful, who pre-exists all that is impersonal, and then he creates the impersonal things. So the things like love and mercy and justice are in fact pre-existent and more important and more meaningful than all the other stuff of this world. But the atheist worldview, the secular worldview, has nothing like that to fall down on, to fall back on. It stumbles over the idea that a chair over here, if given an infinite amount of time, could give birth to love. Now, the problem with this idea, right, is that anything that comes like that, any moral system that you derive like that from the impersonal, is always relative. And, of course, now we run into all the issues that we see around us, right, in our current world. People that constantly make up entire moral systems, and the moral systems can shift. They can change at any time. Now, a lot of people are okay with this. But the funny thing is that we actually all know this to be true, even from children. When I was in college, and we would go in wintertime, and we would take one weekend, and all of the college age group at the church we were attending there, Palm Avenue in Fresno, the college age group, we would all go up to YBC, and it was great. There weren't that many of us, and Yosemite Bible Camp's kind of a big camp, so they would take all us all of us guys, and we'd all stay in this one big room, and all the girls would go over to another cabin area. And one evening, we decided we would invent this game of ball. We called it cabin ball. And it started off where the little beds, the little cot bed things that they had, there was like five on one side and five on another of this room. And so we started on your knees, and then somebody threw the ball across, right? Because somebody had brought a ball. And you know, the first person that decided they would get off their bunk or go on to the neighbor's bunk was told, hey, you can't do that. Okay. Well, why not? And we decided, well, because we decided we'd make up a rule. So we said, you can't go off onto your neighbor's bunk. Okay, start over again. Okay, and somebody at one point stood up on their feet and reached for the ball. And we said, no, you can't stand up. You got to stay on your knees. Well, why? And then we invented this term, the rules clearly state. The rules clearly state. And then it became a running joke for the entire rest of like my whole college career there. It was always a running joke of, well, you know, the rules clearly state. And that was, of course, meaning that the rules didn't clearly state anything at all. We had made the whole thing up. The weird thing is that's not, you know, we were beginning to laugh at it then. But if you go back in time, everybody has experience in elementary school with what I would call the rule creator. You know the kind, right? You're out, you're playing a nice game of hide and seek. And somebody doesn't want to get tagged. And so they invent a rule. They say, hey, no. That's not going to be base. Base is over here. We're changing where base is at. We're like, wait, you can't change where base is at. Yes, I can. And the weird thing about it is if it's somebody that's, you know, especially forceful personality-wise, everybody will kind of go along with it. And then more and more rules will be created to keep that person from, you know, they can do whatever they want in the game at that point because they're generating rules. But the interesting thing is that even as a kid, you understand that all those rules that were created are superfluous, don't you? You can do what you want with them. You don't have to pay attention to them or not. You can just decide to do your own thing. Because once somebody's made up a rule and there's no outside authority that says you can or can't do something, well, then at that point, all rules are equal and all rules are relative. Any system, then, that exists that does not have, I'm going to call it a transcendent, something outside the system that gives it its norms, okay, its ethical system, must come from outside. If it doesn't have that, it begins to become completely relative. And things that are completely relative can change all the time. Now, we see this right in front of our face in the last 20 years, right? In what? The most obvious example of all, in the rise of the acceptability of gay marriage. 20 years ago, that wasn't even something that somebody talked about. It's okay. It was like, oh, we're going to have these things called civil unions. Okay, well, even if we go back before that, it was, no, it's okay. It's okay that they do this, that they get together. And then they did away with sodomy laws, and they did away with the laws that said that it was not okay. And people said, all right. And then along came the idea that somebody might want to have the same tax benefits that a married couple did, and if they're fundamentally this way, and fundamentally a guy that likes another guy, then fundamentally we should give them the same rights, right? Well, okay, well, then we invented this thing called civil unions, and those kind of went around for a while, and a large portion of the as they wish to be called, LGBT community said, no, we don't want marriage at all. That's ridiculous nonsense. And now, of course, you have the concept of marriage for the LGBT community. And if you deny that, you are somehow what? You are evil. It becomes a moral judgment, an ethical judgment. Well, sure it is, because it's made up. It's completely relative. So it was made up. It's like the rules of hide and seek that have been changed. They've been changed on a whim. The really scary thing, at least for the other side that doesn't have a transcendent truth and doesn't believe in a personality that's outside of all existence, is that anything that changed that fast can be changed that fast again. Any system that's created a rule like that in 5 to 10 years can just as easily in 5 to 10 years create a different rule. Maybe one that says something equally heinous, but in the other direction. Maybe one that decides that, no, all the people that are like this, that have this deviant thing, need to all be killed. There's societies on the other side of the globe that feel that way, right? If the system of morals is relative and there is no transcendent personality and everything's begun from the impersonal, then there is no way to have a firm, fixed moral code. Now, the Christian has no problem with this at all. We have a firm, fixed moral code. It comes from God via His Word. It comes via the Bible. See how worldview bends everything. It bends the whole way you see everything around you. A person who has a secular worldview is confused by this whole discussion because they've begun with an impersonal entity and they've moved towards things like love. And they've had to decide how it happened that neurotransmitters and some juicy squirt in your brain decided that you love this person and you would die for them. Where did that come from? And is that important? To the secular mindset, no. It is not important. It is meaningless. Now, very few secular atheists are honest about that. Well, not since the demise of existentialism, right? When you had guys like Camus and stuff who were saying that, yeah, absolutely, it's meaningless. Live with it. Be okay with that. Decide whether or not to commit suicide. But most of our modern people say, no, it's self-evident. It's self-evident that this stuff is good. If all of you just be nice to each other, everything will be okay. So last week was the anniversary of, apparently, I think it was 1948, and they were doing a bunch of pictures of it because in 1948, around this time, Eleanor Roosevelt is out there, and she's holding this big thing, and they had come out with a Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And on this had all these very nice sounding things, right? Things that pretty much most people would agree on. That everybody had human rights of a certain kind, a right for this and a right for that, a right not to be killed meaninglessly, or a right to decide not to kill, I think was one of them, right? So you couldn't, as a human, be forced to kill somebody else. And so you end up with this long list. And these were derived outside of the concept of God. So because they were derived outside the concept of God, they have no meaning. And they have no staying power. And they're garbage. They're not worth the paper they're written on. The worldview of the Christian, I am submitting to you today, is the only actually coherent worldview that exists. Now, usually, when you're in a debate with our current secular society, you are assumed to have a handicap, aren't you? You're assumed to have a handicap of things like faith or belief, which are obviously inferior to hard, cold science, which has given us hard, cold truth, okay? And the science has declared through hard, cold evidence that there is no God. And so we decide that all of religion needs to go off in a corner somewhere and do something on its own. And it's okay for now, okay? But, you know, it's not my thing, but whatever floats your boat, you might hear that. The voice of a relativist. So, I think, though, that based upon the most fundamental understanding of what we are as humans, okay, that we're the only ones that have a worldview that makes even the slightest sense of all at all. In Genesis 1 and 2, you end with the culmination of God creating man. And he says something about man when he creates us, doesn't he? He says, "Let us create man in our own image. This becomes another component, right, to the worldview. So we, as Christians, have no difficulty at all whatsoever with the acknowledgement that we as humans are special in this world. And we are. We as humans are special because, you might say, we have rational thought. Sure, that's fine. Although more and more they're considering that some of the more advanced animals have rational thought too. But I'm going to give you something that humans have that no animal has at all. Humans have an ought, an O-U-G-H-T. Humans have a moral system. Like I've told my class for years, what is the worst thing that a human can do? And usually the first answer is murder. And especially, we elevate it up, right? Premeditated murder. If I go outside here later on and I wait outside for somebody to come out because I know they always come out of a certain building at a certain time, and I plant myself in the bushes and I wait until nighttime when there's not much light in our parking lot, and that person comes out and they walk across the parking lot and I bash them in the head and I beat them to death, that's like the worst thing a human can do, right? But you know what? When a lion hides on the African savannah and waits carefully, like in all those nature shows, and then the zebra comes across and the lion carefully waits until just the right moment, like all cats do, and then pounces and rips the zebra to shreds, viscera going all over the place, blood and guts and gore, you know, they'll put that on in prime time. It's not wrong. It's not an inherent wrong. Nobody goes to the lion and say, "What have you done? This is horrible. You should be locked up." If a lion does that, let's say, like in The Ghost in the Darkness, that movie that came out with like Val Kilmer before he was a complete mess, and it was based upon this the kind of actual time of where a lion was terrorizing this village. So, okay, in that case, you might go out and kill the lion, okay? But nobody says you're killing the lion because the lion is immoral. Nobody says, "We got to kill that lion because that lion is wicked." Nobody says that at all, and nobody believes it. You're killing it because it's causing problems, okay? And it's killing humans. You're actually acknowledging that humans are some sort of special, unique thing. That's why you're killing the lion, okay? But what you are not saying is that the lion is immoral. The lion's just an animal. It does what an animal does. My cat messes all sorts of stuff up in our house. She doesn't do it because she's immoral or unethical. She has no ought. Humans are the only thing that we know of that exists that has a moral system. If you do something wrong, it's wrong. We pronounce it wrong. The humans pronounce it wrong. And something is done to you. Some sort of justice system deals with you. And everyone says, yes, that needs to happen. But why? Is it really just because we're a more advanced chimpanzee? If you begin with the impersonal, that's all you have. If you begin with the impersonal, there is no right and wrong that fundamentally, absolutely exists. You are nothing but a higher animal with more power that can somehow kill a lion because you have a gun. But if you don't, well, too bad for you. Christians have the only worldview that gives us the reason for the universe existing. Christians have the only worldview that gives us the reasons for morals existing. Christians have the only worldview that actually makes, and this is what I'm going to close on, that actually makes this world livable. That actually makes the world livable. If a secular atheist is honest with themselves, they can't live with that. They can't. The only way they can live is by convincing themselves otherwise, by looking away from what it is that they've created, from the scary fact that the universe just doesn't care about you at all. And if you die tomorrow and the earth dries up and the global warming does whatever it does to you, who cares at all? It means nothing. So you kill off the human race a few billion years before the sun would have done it for you anyway. Big deal. That's all you really believe. In a few minutes, we're going to sing the song, "Where Livest Thou?" Where livest thou? Where do you live? To be honest, and I've said this before, a lot of people that are atheists aren't atheists because they really believe all that. They're atheists because they want to sin. And they want to sin freely. And they need a reason to do it without somebody watching. It's embarrassing, right, to have God watching them. The song we're going to sing goes, where are you living? In the pleasures of the world or in that realm where Satan's darts are hurled? But it asks you to make a choice. Choose now to follow with the sons of God. Far better this than where the great have trod. Where do you live? And where can you live? If you're here this evening, or this morning, sorry. If you're here this morning and you're living in a world of sin, and you think that you can live there, you think that you're able to live with the world that you've created for yourself, that is false. It is not true. If you're here this morning and you need the prayers of the church, if you realize that you've been living in sin and you wish for our prayers, and sometimes when people come forward, it strikes me, I get very emotional because we all share in that same sinful problem. That's why we're here. That's why we're here. We're here because of our sin problem. If you have either one of these things, you wish for baptism, you wish for prayers, would you come now as we stand to sing the song that's been selected?